it's repeatedly in recent years invoked the First Amendment to weaken the ability of people to govern themselves. And that goes right to the heart of, can we govern ourselves in the workplace? Can we be organized? Can majority rule? Can majority set contract terms that we all work under?
Today's show is inspired by a post on the ACLU website that my friend John sent me during a debate we were having about a case argued at the Supreme Court last week involving free speech. The post, which we'll link to in the show notes, is titled, "New York's Coercion of Private Companies to Blacklist the NRA Has a Long and Dark History." Here's a sentence that caught my attention. When the Justice Department attempted to put the industrial workers of the world out of business by filing criminal charges against more than 100 members who had called for labor strikes, accusing them of undermining the war effort, the National Civil Liberties Bureau, the ACLU's predecessor, placed an ad seeking funds for the IWW's right of a fair trial. The government responded by coercing the New Republic, a privately run media company, to support its goal by threatening to revoke the magazine's second-class mailing privileges if it reprinted the message. Which meant that this case, National Rifle Association versus VULO, had a deep connection to labor history. So I called up labor historian Joe McCartan to explain. I'm Chris Garlock, and this is Labor History Today.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances."
I guess first we need to start out with what I think a lot of people are sort of confused about. Why is the ACLU defending the National Rifle Association? So can you kind of do a idiot's guide to that?
Sure. So why is the ACLU representing the NRA? It's a good question. but actually, if you study history, it's not all that surprising in some ways. The ACLU had its origins in the World War I years. It grew out of the left-wing opposition to the U.S. entry into the war and people who were trying to prevent that. And once we entered the war, it became focused on defending the rights of those who didn't want to be drafted, for example, who challenged the draft, who were conscientious objectors. It also defended the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which formally never took a position against the war, but many of its activists did actively. And a bunch of them were arrested, put on trial, and convicted under the Espionage Act. So that was the crucible within which the ACLU was formed in those years where civil liberties were really in danger. Now, the first leader of the organization was a guy named Roger Baldwin. And actually, Baldwin, in his early years, had been involved with the IWW when he lived in St. Louis. And he was very much enamored of the IWW's free speech fights, which took place between around 1910 and 1912 in several cities like San Diego, like Fresno, in which the IWW was trying to organize agricultural workers outside of those cities. And they encountered city ordinances that forbid them from basically having public meetings. And so they decided to openly challenge those ordinances by just climbing up on soapboxes on street corners, speaking to workers, fellow worker, you know, and giving an impromptu speech. They'd be quickly arrested. Somebody else would climb up on the box, and pretty soon they'd fill the local jail. Baldwin watched that and he thought that was heroic, and it was sort of an introduction to him to the defense of civil liberties. And when World War I came around, he became involved before the U.S. entered in a group called American Union Against Militarism, which was against U.S. entry. And then once we were in the war, he became involved in the defense of civil liberties. So the American Union Against Militarism created a Civil Liberties Bureau that separated from it and later became the National Civil Liberties Bureau and then evolved into the ACLU. So you could say at the beginning that the ACLU had close ties to labor struggle in that way. But from the beginning, the ACLU's defense of civil liberties really focused on speech, and often individual speech. The defense that the ACLU has made around civil liberties over the years is that civil liberties need to be protected. The minority speech needs to be protected from the majority, being able to suppress it. And if you think about it that way, you can see a line that runs right through to the present and to the ACLU's involvement with the NRA. And in between, the founding years and where we're currently at, there were several occasions where there was real tension evident between the ACLU's approach and thinking, and say what people in the labor movement believed. Like, for example, when the Wagner Act was proposed in 1935, Roger Baldwin was against it. He believed this is going to be a government effort to regulate how unions get formed, and he wanted no part of that. It actually caused a lot of internal dissension within the ACLU. There were other people that said that's a crazy way to think about this. Of course, we need, this act to protect workers' rights to organize and bargain collectively. In the end, Baldwin had to sort of back down from his position, and he did. And by the World War II years, the ACLU had not only moved away from that early sort of suspicion of the Wagner Act to a kind of embrace of the rights that it conferred, to the point that when the Taft-Hartley Act was passed in 1947, trying to weaken the Wagner Act, the ACLU actually urged Truman to veto it, which Truman did, but then, he was overridden, of course. But to get back to this tension at the heart of things, right after World War II, the NAACP, the organization that began the long fight for civil rights, initiated a national boycott of the Amos and Andy radio program, right? They were justifiably outraged that that very popular radio program, in which it employed only white actors, by the way, who sort of impersonated in a kind of black-faced minstrelsy way, black characters, in a way that was very stereotyped and prejudiced and racist. The NAACP urged that people boycott the show and put pressure on the advertisers to the show. The ACLU thought that that was a mistake. It opposed it. And it believed that, you shouldn't try to stifle speech in this way by using collective action, in this case, a boycott. So over time, the ACLU sort of backed away from that kind of thinking as well. But, its early opposition to the Wagner Act, or its feeling that a boycott is a dangerous thing. If you think about those things, it helps explain how it arrives at this position defending the NRA. In the case of New York, the ACLU became concerned that the state was actively lobbying for groups not to do business with the NRA. And although the ACLU, I think, has never really been a great defender of the Second Amendment that the NRA is all concerned about, it saw that kind of state intervention as a kind of dangerous thing. And so it finds itself on that side of the case. So the long history of the ACLU kind of explains how this could come about. And even though it began, as the kind of organization it was led by radicals. Baldwin was a radical. It can, following that logic, end up in this place.
I mean, you've got an organization that gets started defending the IWW for speaking out against the war, I'm assuming because, you know, the IWW stand that the wars are fought by the working class folks for the rich and that we're fighting against each other. So perfectly reasonable. But then the labor movement, I mean, we believe in collective action. So whether it's a boycott right. or a rally, you could probably reel off a half a dozen examples. I mean, without collective action, what are we? Right.
Exactly.
And so I find myself really conflicted because on the one hand, it makes sense to me that we're not allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater. And it makes sense that the government should be able to say, you know, you can't put out misinformation about COVID or ivermectin is a good thing. That seems to make sense to me. On the other hand, I don't want the government prosecuting, you know, labor folks, right? So I find myself kind of honestly confused by this.
Well, I think that's natural. And I think it's the best response here because you're able to hold two different thoughts in place here, which I think is the appropriate thing to do. I think it is confusing. Honestly, in this case, I hope that the ACLU loses it because I think it's important that we, in the interest of the common good, push back against how the NRA has really undermined our sense of physical safety in our society now, with all the shootings we've had and all of their opposition to any regulation. But it gets at really what's true, I think, Chris, in any democracy that really is functional, is that there will always be a tension between majority rule and minority rights. And that's a good thing. The problem is when minority rights start to trump majority rule. And indeed, I think we've started to see that in recent years. There's an interesting concept that some people in the law have started to point out about recent years, the direction of the Supreme Court in the use of the First Amendment to knock down majority rule, to undermine regulation. And they've given a very interesting term to this approach, and they call it First Amendment Lochnerism. And for any of your listeners who know the Lochner case, that was a 1905 Supreme Court case which dominated and destroyed, you know, basically any regulatory approach to labor relations before the New Deal, because it said that almost any kind of government regulation of the workplace, like setting a minimum wage, setting, you know, hours of labor, that was an infringement on the liberty of contract between the employer and the employee. The state should not interfere with that liberty. And by holding to this kind of arcane and kind of detached from the real world position, as the court did for years, the court knocked down efforts to ban child labor, for example. It knocked down efforts to set minimum wages for working women, which it tried to do, which was tried in several states. Basically, it undercut all of the will of the majority of people who said, we've got labor problems in this country. It's not a good thing when children are being forced out of the home instead of school to work to support their families. We need to stop this. And the court repeatedly invoked this doctrine to undermine it. And sadly, we've seen in recent years, the Supreme Court is applying that same kind of, you know, fixated logic, you might say, to the labor questions of our time. The approach that overturned Lochnerism was called legal realism. Because it was advanced by people who are like, this is not the way the world actually works. You talk about liberty of contract, but one side has all the power to make a contract. The other is like forced into a contract. Otherwise, they starve.
Right.
So like what kind of liberty is that? So, you know, realism is required. And I think, unfortunately, you know, the court today is populated by, you know, six ideologues who, you know, really have almost no real interaction with the real world. And never did. Consider the Janus decision of recent years. What did the Supreme Court do then? It said that in the public sector, you cannot have an agreement between a union and its workers where workers who are represented by the union have to pay for the cost of that representation. And the court said, well, no, you can't require anybody to pay for the cost of that representation because maybe the union will take a position that violates the thinking of the person paying for this representation. And so using that logic, it basically tried to put a dagger in the nation's public sector unions into their finances. And it's repeatedly in recent years invoked the First Amendment to weaken the ability of people to govern themselves. And that goes right to the heart of, can we govern ourselves in the workplace? Can we be organized? Can majority rule? Can majority set contract terms that we all work under? You get to vote for whether to be in a union or not. It's kind of like government. But in this case, they're basically taking a position of the First Amendment trumps all, and it wipes out any other powers that should adhere to the majority. And that's, I think, unfortunately, the ACLU over its history, if it's not careful, and it's happened repeatedly, like in the 1935, it gets pulled in this direction of invoking, individual rights in a way that undermine collective power and the common good. And it's periodically had to rebalance itself. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next years it has to rebalance itself again around these questions.
Well, Joe, it's a thorny thicket, and I appreciate
It
you taking some time to bring some light to help us sort of cut through this. So appreciate it.
Always, Chris.
Joe McCartin, he's a historian of the U.S. labor movement and 20th century U.S. social and political history. Joe's books include Labor's Great War, The Struggle for Industrial Democracy, and The Origins of Modern American Labor Relations. A professor of history at Georgetown University, he's also the executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. The most important word in the language of the working class is solidarity. Those inspiring words were spoken by labor leader Harry Bridges, who died on this day in labor history. The year was 1990. Harry was born into a middle-class family in Melbourne, Australia. At the age of 14, his father put him to work collecting rents in Melbourne slums, an experience that gave young Harry a heart for struggling people. At 16, he joined the Merchant Marines, landing in the United States just 3 years later. At the San Francisco docks, he joined the International Longshore Association, which was organizing against the company union. On May 9, 1934, Harry helped lead a strike of the West Coast docks. Furious shipping company owners and politicians retaliated violently on what became known as Bloody Thursday. Police beat, shot, and wounded longshoremen up and down the coast. Employers offered Bridges a $50,000 bribe to win his support, but he refused. The union's leadership brokered a deal to end the strike, but the dock workers roundly rejected it. Instead of settling, Bridges contacted other unions at port cities and convinced them to support a general strike. The general strike lasted 4 days and won the longshoremen an agreement that included shorter hours, increased pay, and safer working conditions. 3 years later, Bridges split from the International Longshore Association and helped found the International Longshore Workers Union, affiliated under the CIO. Harry became the West Coast director for the CIO. Throughout his life, Harry advocated for democratic unionism, including open mics at meetings, direct elections of union leaders by rank and file membership, and member referendums on contract proposals. The U.S. government continually harassed Bridges, accusing him of communist sympathies. Despite this harassment, the ILWU became one of the leading voices of the U.S. labor movement.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Hey, that's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Even better, if you like what you hear, sure hope you do. Like it in your podcast app, pass it along, and leave a review. That really helps folks to find the show. Labor History in Two is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. That's a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Our music today was Song to Memorize the First Amendment from Sherry Boeg and Freedom of Speech by John Mellencamp. Labor History Today is produced by the Labor Heritage Foundation and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. You can keep up with all the latest labor arts news. Subscribe to the Labor Heritage Foundation's weekly newsletter at laborheritage.org, which we've just updated, so check it out, give it a look. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Keep making history, and see you next time.
Freedom of thought, freedom of dreams, freedom to believe that we all can be kings.